from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Danny Wei was trying to do something no one had ever done: jump the Great Wall of China on a skateboard. On his practice jump, he swooped down the ramp, soared into the air, only to crash, breaking an ankle, tearing an ACL, and mangling a foot. 24 hours later, barely able to walk, he hobbled up the ramp, zoomed down again, and this time succeeded. And then, on an absurdly swollen foot and broken ankle, he did it four more times. He'd reached what super athletes call a state of flow. What flow is, and what it can do for people like you and me, we'll discover after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. There's a zone I get into. Everything goes silent. Time slows down. It's the most peaceful feeling I've ever known. That's skateboarder Danny Wei describing what's also known as flow, a peak state that author Stephen Cutler says sits at the heart of almost every athletic championship, underpins major scientific breakthroughs, and accounts for significant progress in the arts. Cutler writes about flow in his new book, The Rise of Superman: Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. His premise is that extreme athletes, daredevils, skateboarders, skiers, solo mountaineers, surfers, all depend on flow. And if we can learn their secrets, we can find our way to flow as well. And Stephen Cutler joins us this morning. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you join us. So I gave that brief little definition by way of the skateboarder Danny Wei, the zone, as sometimes people refer to it as. But take it a beat further, if you would, Stephen Cutler, because we hear these words, the zone, or peak performance, or peak experience, flow. Give us your best definition of what they are, and whether that, those are all different animals or one and the same.
It's a tricky question, because until very recently, we believed they were all the same. Let's start with the definition of flow. Flow, scientists describe it as an optimal state of consciousness where we feel our best and we perform our best. It's got certain kind of fundamental characteristics that define it, seven that have been established in flow. Attention gets so laser focused that we're totally absorbed in the moment. Action and awareness start to merge. Time dilates, so it slows down. You get that freeze frame effect like in a car crash. Sometimes it speeds up and 5 hours will pass by in 5 minutes. Your sense of self, your sense of self-consciousness disappear completely. And throughout, all aspects of performance, mental and physical, go through the roof. And flow, the reason scientists prefer flow is it's actually a technical term. Flow research dates back 150 years. In the middle of this period, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who was the chairman of the University of Chicago Psychology Department, conducted what we would now call the largest global happiness study ever. He went around the world asking people about the times in their life they felt their best and they performed their best, and they kept coming back to him and saying, well, when I'm at my best, every action, every decision means seamlessly, fluidly to the next. In other words, flow feels flowy, and flow is the term that kept coming up, so he renamed the state flow. And then, of course, Phil Jackson came along, and it became runner's high or in the zone.
The famous basketball coach.
Runner's high is another synonym. If you're a basketball player today, you call it being unconscious. If you were a beatnik jazz musician, it was in the pocket, right? The terminology is endless, but flow is the term scientists prefer.
So I described in the promotional bit that precedes the newscast before our discussion began, the story of Danny Wei jumping over the Great Wall of China, which you describe in your book, and this sort of phenomenal situation where he on his takeoff practice run, he crashes, you know, breaks an ankle, mangles a foot, tears an ACL. 24 hours later, he does it not once, but like five times. So what allowed him, in your assessment of that, to be in that state that you described, that would do something which would otherwise seem completely impossible?
I know what happened, and it still seems completely impossible. One of the things that's happened since Csikszentmihalyi's time is neuroscience has advanced so much that we can kind of peel back the veil. We now have some understanding of what's going on beneath the hood. So a couple things are happening in flow that are relevant. Let's just talk about the pain relief, right? He had, as you mentioned, a totally mangled leg. So one of the things that happens in flow is the brain is flooded with five different neurochemicals, two of which are incredibly, incredibly potent painkillers. You get endorphins, which is what's fabled associated with flow. What most people don't realize is the most common endorphin in the brain is 100 times more powerful than medical morphine. So there's a massive amount of pain relief that actually comes with it. We also, in flow, parts of the brain are actually shutting off. So why does self disappear? Why does time disappear? It's because the parts of the brain that generate those things disappear. So when self disappears, something funny happens. We have what's known as absolute strength versus maximal strength. Maximal strength is how much strength we can access at any given day. It's roughly about 65% of our strength because there's a governor on it. The body doesn't want to let you use all your strength at all times because you'll hurt yourself. As your sense of self disappears, that governor is downregulated. So not only was he feeling no pain, a lot of the systems in his body that he needed to perform were massively jacked up, and kind of it goes on from there.
So is that another example that you often hear people say, and maybe it's part fable, but I imagine it actually happens in fact. You know, the person who can lift up a car to free a child that's pinned underneath. Same phenomena?
Same phenomena. So there is a difference between the fight or flight response, which is kind of what you're talking about. That's what it's usually associated with, and a flow state. But they share – there's a lot of neurochemical overlap, and in either case, what you're talking about when the woman lifts the car off the baby or whatever the apocryphal story is, yes, that's exactly the same thing.
And what about – you hear athletes say baseball season starts in a couple of days, and you'll hear baseball players, for example, say when they're on a hot streak, the ball looks huge. Time slows down. I'm in the zone. What's going on with that?
So in flow, as I pointed out, there's a big neurochemical dump. Besides endorphins and anandamide, which are pain relievers, you also get dopamine and norepinephrine. Both are focusing chemicals. They drive focus up. They enhance the amount of information we're taking in per second, how deeply we're processing it, and how quickly we're processing it. They also jack up pattern recognition. Why does the ball get so big? Because literally our attention systems are getting more energy than at any other time. So we're taking in way more information. Same reason basketball where the hoop looks gigantic, same phenomenon.
And so how do you get there? I mean, this is, of course, is the big question. But obviously, if an athlete could routinely access that state, athletes wouldn't need steroids to hit 73 home runs or whatever. You'd have it in-house, right? So is it something that can be, in your judgment, routinely accessed?
Routinely is the tricky – the answer is yes. So let me – but it's entirely individual. So we now know that there are 17 flow triggers. These are preconditions that bring on the state of flow. We also know that there is a flow cycle. The old belief was that flow was a binary, like a light switch. You were either in the zone or out of the zone. Turns out that's not the case. It's actually flow is a four-stage cycle. A couple of those stages don't feel flowy at all. They actually feel awful. But if you know where you are in the cycle and you can understand and read that like a map and it's not all that complicated and apply these 17 triggers, you can generate more flow. So in RISE, I focus on action adventure sport athletes. One of the reasons I focus on them, and we know this from a lot of research, they get into flow far more reliably than just about any other population. Why? Action adventure sports is packed with these 17 flow triggers. They're everywhere in action sports, and action adventure sport athletes started to depend on flow so much that they went from kind of what was an intuitive necessity into something that was conscious.
Well, and the other reason, of course, why they're perhaps more present in these extreme sports is because if you don't have them, you could die. I mean, well, the consequences are pretty extreme.
And that's exactly what happened. I mean, what has happened in action adventure sports in the past 25 years is something astounding. We've seen near exponential growth in ultimate human performance. So performance when life on limb is on the line has grown that fast. Nothing like this has ever happened before. It's sports performance, sports progression is slow, it's steady, it's governed by the laws of evolution. At no point in history does it quintuple in a decade. But that's exactly what we're seeing in all the action sports. And the reason is, as the level of performance has gone up and up and up, it's become necessary. These athletes aren't in flow. They're going home, in a body bag. They're going to the hospital. It's without flow, they can't have a long career. And this, by the way, is not regular sports. There was a study done by Ken Revisa at Cal State Fullerton who looked at flow states in regular bat and ball sport athletes, track and field. And while they all depend on flow, and there's usually flow at the heart of their gold medal championships and things like that, it's a rare experience, whereas in action and adventure sports, it's almost a daily occurrence.
So give me a couple of your favorite examples of flow functioning in one of these extreme athlete situations. And then we'll begin to talk about how you can, because your point of the book, of course, is not just for – it's not a book for skateboarders. Your idea is essentially that these are possibilities available to all of us. But just by way of giving us the context, give us a story or two that to you is iconic for what flow gives an extreme athlete.
Well, one of the stories I love the most is Dean Potter. So Dean Potter is a climber, and he's a free soloist, meaning he climbs without ropes. He, you know, just chalk bag and shoes. And at, you know, at the time, the story I want to talk about takes place kind of around 2000. And in and around then, people were free soloing, 100-foot walls, 200-foot walls in the intermediate range. Dean went down to Patagonia alone, solo, and free soloed gigantic mountains, some of the most difficult mountains, mixed climbing routes in the history of the world. And what's so incredible about this is he, to do this, he would have to stay in flow 2 or 3 days at a time. So it wasn't like, you know, Danny Way jumped the Great Wall of China on a skateboard 5 times in a row, but that was still 30 total seconds of performance, right? It's amazing, but each one of those trips was about 7 seconds, maybe 10 seconds. So maybe it's a minute's worth of performance. Dean was in flow and performing at that level for 3-4 days at a time. That's astounding to me.
Now, I'm fascinated that you'd bring up that example, because that's one of the stories you tell where actually I had a big question, and here's what it is. Well, let me read a little bit of what he says. He says at one point he's on the mountain face and he isn't quite sure what he's going to do. And he says, I had no idea which was the right way to go, but I started following the footholds, listening to a voice and not questioning. And then he goes on, you go on to describe the story about how he was committed to seeing, he saw a crack in the face that seemed to be calling to him, really beckoning and following accordingly. Here's my question, Stephen. How do we know what that voice was? How do we know it was the right voice? How do we know that 14 other climbers heard a voice? It was the wrong voice. They fell and died.
Well, sort of two answers in there. First of all, you're right. Everybody will tell you there's a famous, I think, Scott Schmidt, the extreme skier quote, which is flow makes you feel invincible up until the moment you're not, right? So the first of all, that is very, very true. The voice is the voice of intuition. So our intuition is always on. It never turns off. But there is a massive amount of clutter and complexity in between us hearing that voice. And not sometimes people hear it as a voice. Athletes, extreme athletes, tend to hear it as a voice, and I don't know why. Some people see pictures, they get gut instincts, whatever. So it's not just a visual thing or not just an auditory thing. But a lot of people, and in my own experience actually, when I'm skiing or something like that, I hear it as a voice as well. But all the clutter is removed in flow. As I said earlier, parts of the brain are deactivating. So literally everything that normally stands between us and our intuition is turned off. Now, the second question you got at, which to me is one of the giant mysteries of flow, which is where does the information come from? Because what's amazing about Dean is, yes, you get very heightened information. All the brain's basic information processing systems are way jacked up in flow. But Dean was climbing a 2,000-foot wall. You cannot see up above from below a 2,000-foot wall. And everywhere the voice told him to go, it was perfect. And there was no way to downclimb. There was nothing. So where did that information come from is a giant mystery. And nobody is entirely certain, right? You want to believe that it's pattern recognition and the brain. But a part of it, you look at it and you go, there's something else going on here and we don't quite understand what it is.
And my question or concern about this is, how do you know what to trust? Because you have to believe that there are other people who, as I say, heard a voice, but it was the wrong voice. And they climbed in the wrong direction and they fell and they died. I mean, this is not something where the consequences are small.
No. You're very right. And, the only answer I could give you, which is the answer the athletes, you know, have given to myself, is one of the things that sets these guys apart is they get to experience flow so regularly. Most people get into flow so rarely that when they're there, it feels like a giant quasi-mystical experience, and they don't quite know what to do with it. These athletes are getting into flow so regularly, they're training in it, and I think they're getting a sense of when to listen. Now, one of the things that everybody will say, one of the misconceptions about these guys is that they're adrenaline junkies. Most of them can't stand adrenaline. Most of these guys will tell you if they're feeling adrenaline, especially before they do something, they're feeling too much fear and they'll back off. They won't do it. So I do think one of the things that is going on is as you get better and better, you get to be able to kind of separate what is the flow state from the adrenaline response, and you kind of like that whole like Kodak courage thing goes out the window, and they're really relying on their intuition. But can your intuition be wrong? Clearly. I mean, I always tell people in flow, one of the things not to do is don't go shopping, because everything looks great and you're going to come home, you're going to spend thousands of dollars that you don't really want to spend.
Stephen Kotler, our guest, his new book is The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. So let's take this forward and hear something about why you think this state is important, not just for people who are free soloing up a mountain or daredevil skiing or skateboarding over the Great Wall of China, but for you and me, for people who want to attain a state where they can be at their best, essentially. Why are these techniques, these skills, this state, why is that important to it being a good writer or a good talk show host or whatever it happens to be? And then how do you get there? How do you learn from the free solo mountain climber and apply that to being a best-selling author, as you happen to be?
So one of the mistakes, flow has become very associated with athletics in recent years. We've heard a lot about it in that context. But a lot of the early research actually was into creatives. So we know flow massively enhances creativity. We can come back to that in a second. But let's talk about flow in business. McKinsey and Company just did a 10-year study. They found top executives in flow are 5 times more productive than out of flow. So 5 times is 500% more productive. It means you could go to work on Monday in flow, take Tuesday through Friday off, and get as much done as your steady state.
And describe a businessman in flow. What does that mean?
Well, flow is just a heightened sense of concentration where we lose ourselves in the moment. I mean, one of the famous studies on flow found there's a state known as group flow, which is when a bunch of people get into a flow state together. So if you've ever seen a fourth quarter comeback in football, chances are you're looking at group flow. Group flow is very, very, very common in startups among entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. Why? Because a lot of the flow triggers that drive it are present in startups. In fact, Salim Ismail, who is the former head of innovation at Yahoo and now the global ambassador from Singularity University, believes that flow may be the difference between startups that succeed and startups that fail. So it shows up, although if you've ever taken part in a brainstorming session, you probably experience group flow. So that's a simple example of flow in business.
And how do we what does the businessman learn from Dean Potter? I mean, okay. How does climbing up a mountain get you to where you need to be when you're running your business?
Okay, so as I said earlier, there are 17 triggers that bring on group flow. Let's talk there are 3 environmental triggers, 3 psychological triggers, 10 social triggers, and 1 creative trigger. Let's talk about the 3 environmental triggers, because these are what the action sport athletes rely on the heaviest, and let's apply them to business or other places. So of these 3 triggers, the first one is the obvious one. Flow, first of all, this is the thing you need to know about the triggers. Flow follows focus. So every one of these triggers is a way of driving attention into the now. First trigger is known as high consequences. Why? Because flow follows focus and consequences catch our attention, right? Why are these athletes, they're putting themselves in very, very dangerous situations. It's driving focus. It's precipitating flow. But when you look under the hood at the neurobiology of it, what you discover is what they're really trying to get at is the dopamine reaction that shows up whenever we take a risk. But the important thing is, yes, you do need risk to drive flow, but it doesn't have to be physical risk. You can take a social risk, an emotional risk, a creative risk, an intellectual risk, and it's totally independent on based on the individual. So for Dean Potter, he's got to go climb a 1,000-foot wall without ropes to do this. But the shy guy just has to put up his hand and speak up at the meeting to pull this trigger. So it's very, very individual, and you don't need the physical consequences. You can use intellectual, creative, whatever. As a writer, for example, you asked about that. I know that when I'm writing really, really well, what I'm writing is making me a little bit uncomfortable. I think really in good writing, there's a level of truth-telling and vulnerability that has to come through. And most of the time, I'm uncomfortable with it. So I know I'm aiming – that's kind of emotional risk-taking, right?
So in intrinsic to this ability to get to this state is pushing yourself beyond your comfort zone. It's saying it's you're asking more of yourself.
For sure. And that's – that. We'll jump to one of the psychological triggers, probably the most famous one, which is known as the challenge skills ratio. So flow exists emotionally sort of near the midpoint between anxiety and boredom, right? If the task you're working on is too dull, it doesn't hold your attention. And if it's too hard, it pushes you into a fight or flight and you have a fear response. There's a sweet spot. It's called the flow channel, or it's the if you're a biologist, it's the end of the Yerkes-Dodson curve. But this means that the task I'm doing, the challenge of it is slightly harder than the skills I'm bringing to bear. So you want to stretch but not snap. Interestingly, this is where a lot of people screw up actually in the regular world. Underachievers tend to not push hard enough because the sweet spot is actually, as I just pointed out, the point at which you start to get pretty uncomfortable. But overachievers, really driven people, blow by that sweet spot. They will bite off a huge problem because they will keep themselves out of flow. So for really, really high achievers, slow and steady runs this race. For people who are less motivated, they have to learn that that really deep sense of uncomfortability is actually a good thing, and it means that they're driving in the right direction.
How does that sense of discomfort sync up with another aspect of what you describe, which is this sense that you are time is sort of stopped, that you're so engaged with what you're doing that sort of nothing else matters. I know, for example, when I feel like I'm writing the best, the words almost seem inevitable, that mm-hmm. there's no other sentence I can write than the one that comes out. But that doesn't feel risky to me.
No. And by the way, there are, as I said, 17 triggers. We talked about high consequences. That's the only one that actually involves risk. The challenge skills balance, maybe the challenge skills balance also involves a little bit of risk. But for example, another psychological trigger is clear goals. When goals are clear, meaning we know what we're doing and we know what we're going to do next, attention can stay focused in the now. Where people screw this up, by the way, especially in the Western world where you say something like clear goals, is they hear goals and they think, oh, the point is my goal. No, the point is actually the clarity, knowing exactly what you're doing. Goals, we've all seen kind of that the drop pass at the final seconds of the Super Bowl, the missed putt. Like we've seen those choking moments. That's what happens when you focus on the goals too much. But clear goals. Here's a flow trigger that has nothing to do with risk. It just means know what you're doing and know what you're doing next.
Stephen Coulter, The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. We have to stop and take a short break, and when we return, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this, your own experiences with this. If you are someone who has had a flow experience, whether that's in extreme athletics, everyday athletics, in business, in art, or in science, you can join our conversation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website. And when we come back, we'll hear more from Stephen Cutler about what this experience actually is. How do you achieve it? How do you get to that state of flow in whatever profession you pursue? We'll hear more of his book, more of his stories, and how you can get into that state as well. 866-733-6786. More from Stephen Cutler and The Rise of Superman when we return. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Stephen Cutler is our guest. The book, The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. We welcome your calls and contributions to our program at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Post your thoughts on our Facebook page as well. early in the book, Stephen, you have a quote that I like very much from the civil rights leader Howard Thurman, who says, don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. Because what the world needs most is more people who've come alive. Is that so much of what you would like people to take from this? Not to necessarily take up extreme sports, but to come alive.
Oh, yeah.
Because this is what cuts across so many professions.
Absolutely. And we know from Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's work has been validated everywhere. The people who have the highest degree of life satisfaction are the people with the most flow in their lives. And this is an extremely well-established fact. So there's a very tight correlation between flow and life satisfaction. There's a deep correlation between flow and massively heightened motivation. Psychologists and scientists talk about flow as the source code of intrinsic motivation. There are neurobiological reasons for this, but flow is – if activities drive you into flow, you are – at your best there. So, and it's different for everybody, right? For some people, it's extreme sports. For me, it was writing. But there are lots of different gateways into flow. But you got to figure out what those are and drive in that direction.
So your argument is not that the extreme athlete, the Danny Way skateboarder example we talked about in the first part of our program, not that those professions have more value than, let's say, a high school teacher. It's that the high school teacher who has to, in his or her own way, contend with everything, something that's just as dangerous, risky, and challenging as skateboarding, needs to tap into that as well.
For sure. Absolutely. The reason that action-adventure sport athletes are at the center of this book is because I'm using them like case studies. Same way that Malcolm Gladwell tells sociology stories or business stories, I'm using these athletes as case studies. Why? Because this is a very subjective, flimsy experience, and it's very hard. How do we know our research subjects are in flow? That we know if the athletes are surviving what they're doing, they're in flow. So it gives us a hard data set with which to work. So we use them to figure out what everybody else – like, can we take this information and apply it across all domains in society? The answer is yes, and that's what's important.
So sketch out for us how that might work in a profession that might not be as obvious. I said high school teacher a moment ago. It could be anything. But let's stay with that for a moment. How are these skills important for kids to learn, for teachers to possess? We focus a lot, worry a lot about whether our education system is preparing people for the 21st century. How do those dots connect?
Well, so the dots connect. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi again and Kevin Orthunde, who's an education expert at the University of Utah in the late 90s, early 2000s, went looking for, outside of action adventure sports, what's the highest flow environment they could find? What did they find? Montessori education. And there are reasons for that. Montessori education is built around 90-minute periods of uninterrupted concentration, so you get massive amounts of focus. It is self-directed learning, so it's intrinsically motivated. It's follow your own curiosity. Why is passion important? People talk about passion all the time like it's this big mysterious thing. Passion is important because the things that we care about, we pay more attention to, and it drives us more into flow. And the other thing about Montessori education, we were talking earlier about the environmental triggers. One of the environmental triggers action-adventure sport athletes rely on is known as deep embodiment. It means you're paying attention to multiple sensory streams at once. Montessori education is often called embodied education. Why? Because it emphasizes learning through doing. Don't just read about the windmill, go out and build one. Mm-hmm. This grabs hold of our attention, drives us into now. So we know, why do Montessori students outperform regular students on pretty much every kind of test you can imagine? Well, it's a massively high-flow environment. We know flow – I didn't say this earlier, but one of the reasons everybody should care about flow, flow massively accelerates learning. In studies run by the military, snipers in flow learn 200 to 500% better than normal. So this research suggests that Malcolm Gladwell's fabled 10,000 hours to mastery, flow appears to cut them in half.
To our callers, Aaron gets us started in San Francisco. Aaron, go ahead.
Thank you. So I think this is a great conversation, and I want to say from my own experience, I'm 41 right now. I spent my whole life from early childhood all the way up through college and well into my 30s playing basketball and at a pretty high level at some points. And I don't think I ever really experienced flow there. And in the last couple of years, I have started swimming at the Dolphin Club here in the city. And swimming in the bay, I really think I have started to, not every time, but I've started to get into this, and I think one of the key things that I can point to is I think your guest was just talking about passion, and it's something that I was always passionate about basketball, but there's a pursuit of joy and a kind of losing myself when I get in the water. It's not about me at all. It's just about putting myself in an environment that has nothing to do with me, doesn't even know or care I exist. But I go into this and I just kind of say, I'm just going to kind of be out here, and I'm just going to give it my best, and I'm just going to feel it and let it happen and be a part of it. And not every time, but a good percentage of the time, in the middle of my swim, I've just, like, I can't even really describe it accurately. It's just, I'm just kind of, it's just sort of happening, and I'm reaching levels of kind of performance and engagement that are surprising to me. And I walk around with it. The rest, I'm able to apply it to a lot of other parts of my day.
Aaron, thank you. Thanks for the story. Stephen.
Well, I'm not going to comment about why, you know, swimming works in basketball. Swimming, especially if you're swimming in the open ocean, another trigger for flow is novelty. We call it a rich environment, which means lots of novelty, complexity, and unpredictability. So obviously the open ocean has a lot more novelty, complexity, and unpredictability than a basketball court, which could be one of the reasons. It also basketball is up and down depending on how much you were playing. Swimming requires a lot more fitness under certain conditions, and the exercise-induced transient hypofrontality. Some of the shutting down of the prefrontal cortex that takes place in flow, some of the neurochemicals, exhaustion is, for a lot of people, it's a gateway drug into flow. And it just, you know, we're all wired differently. Everybody gets into the state differently. It might be that, you know, Aaron was better wired for, you know, swimming than basketball, and it just took him a long time to figure that out.
Aaron, thanks for the call. Aaron also described this sense of sort of losing yourself, and it's sort of easy to imagine that in a sense when you're in the ocean as opposed to many other environments. But take that a little bit further, if you would, Stephen, about why that's important, losing yourself.
Let's just talk about why it happens. And we've talked about this earlier, about the deactivation of the prefrontal cortex. So flow is caused – one of their causes is known as transient, temporary, hypo, H-Y-P-O, frontality. Hypo is the opposite of hyper. It means to slow down, to deactivate. Frontality is the prefrontal cortex.
And that's the sort of thinking, cognitive
center of the brain. It's where all your higher cognitive functions are housed. So early –
and this gets disengaged?
It turns off in flow. We used to believe that there was the 10% brain myth, right? People misinterpreted William James. They thought, oh, we only use 10% of our brain most of the time. So flow, optimal performance must be the brain firing on all cylinders. Turns out they had it backwards. Parts of the brain aren't actually firing on all cylinders. They're deactivating. So why does time pass so strangely in flow? Time is calculated all over the prefrontal cortex, and as parts of it start to wink out, we can't perform the calculations. We can no longer separate past from present from future, so we're plunged into a deep now. Why does self vanish in flow? Because self is another thing that's calculated all over the place. For example, there's a part of your brain known as the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex. This part turns off in flow. It's part of your brain that is responsible for impulse control and self-monitoring. It's your inner critic, that nagging, defeatist voice that's always in your head, that's always second-guessing. So why is creativity so free-flowing in flow? One of the reasons is because the part of your brain that is meant to govern that and keep it in check and say, oh, that's not a great idea, you shouldn't write that sentence, you know, that kind of thing, it's turned off. So we experience this as liberation of freedom. We are literally getting out of our own way.
I often say to people who ask about interviewing that oftentimes the best questions are the ones that just pop into your head, and you have to give yourself permission to ask those in the moment they occur, because otherwise you tuck them away or you convince yourself 14 reasons why that's not the great question to ask. But in fact, they almost always are. Stephen in Mountain View is next. Stephen, go ahead. Stephen,
yeah,
are you with us? Go ahead.
I'm with you. I'm interested in the fact that, for me, flow seems to happen, the gateway seems to be in music more often than in any other situation, although I think I've experienced it in other situations as well. And I can certainly understand the more kinesthetic approach. It seems to me that the fact that words and sequential logic is more or less not necessary in attaining a state of flow in music may have something to do with what you're talking about in terms of shutting certain things down to open up certain other channels. So I was wondering what you thought about that.
Well, first of all, as you know, I don't know what instrument you play, but there's obviously a huge kinesthetic component to, you know, playing music, that deep embodiment trigger where you're paying attention to multiple sensory streams at once. And if you're playing guitar and you're singing along, you know, there's a lot of different inputs coming in at once and a lot of different things you're paying attention to. But one of the other things that we know is that flow is triggered by creativity. It's really, it's just under, when you look under the hood of that, creativity is usually some combination of kind of, there's risk-taking involved, first of all, in all creativity if you're going to make it public, right? So there's risk in playing music, especially if there's other people around. And there's also pattern recognition, the linking of ideas together in new ways, and which happens all the time, especially in improvisation. This is a deep, deep flow trigger, which is why flow is, you know, there's, you know, it's so famous in music, basically.
What do you think is going on in music, and maybe this is also part of what Stephen is getting at, that sometimes allows people or to literally move when they aren't otherwise? Oliver Sacks, the neurologist, has written about this in Musicophilia, and that people with Parkinson's disease or sometimes other neurological conditions hear a musical trigger and they're able to move in a certain way, which is also interesting when you think about in that particular condition, there's a lack of dopamine. So you wonder about what is going on here.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's very well understood, but there's something interesting that must be happening neurologically.
Well, the two things I can think of, and I have not looked at this at all, so you know, I take this with a grain of salt. But one thing you did point out, we know flow produces large quantities of dopamine, and people with Parkinson's are given L-DOPA, right, to increase dopamine because it smooths over muscle firing patterns. So that's part of it. We also know there's pain relief that shows up in flow. So all these things make a factor. And by the way, when your sense of self disappears, right, the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, when that goes quiet, your inner critic gets shut. That's a, you know, that inner critic exists to tell you what you can't do.
Stephen, thank you. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Simon. Simon, go ahead. You're on, please.
Hi. Hi, Dave. First time caller, long time fan. I just want to make two points. It seems like flow seems like the ultimate form of self-actualization from Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And two, coming from the tech industry, it actually is very interesting that you mentioned earlier that flow comes from rock climbers and from startups. Because coming from both, we know that there, or from personal experience, I know that a lot of startups or a lot of tech people rock climb and CrossFit. And I'm wondering the translation between your career to your leisure or different lifestyles that you, if it applies.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you, Simon. First on the Maslow, because that's something that I'm sure a lot of people must be thinking about. And then on the sort of interconnection between rock climbing and Silicon Valley.
They're both great, great questions. So there is a difference between state and stage development, right? The self-actualization is a stage. Flow is a state. So stages are long developmental periods. Look, if flow led to self-actualization, all the athletes I write about in my book would be Buddhas, right? And that's clearly – that's obviously not the case. So you can – flow will – you know, does facilitate stage development. It lets you kind of move up that ladder. But you can also get very, very stuck. So the, but you definitely – you know, Maslow was talking about peak experiences, that feeling of oneness with everything, of that's the realization. And we know, by the way, that's also caused by transient hypofrontality. Why do people feel one with everything? Because there's a part of your brain that separates self from other. It's the right parietal lobe. It helps you navigate through spaces. So people who have strokes or brain damage to this area can't sit down on a couch because they don't know where their leg ends and the couch begins. When this, in intense moments of concentration that you get in flow, you also shows up in meditation, same thing, this portion of the brain starts to shut down so you can no longer separate self from other. That was the experience Maslow was getting at, and it can absolutely be produced by flow. I think there's some problems with Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I don't think it works as kind of smoothly as he laid that out. And I think, by the way, Maslow agreed with that later in his life. He said, you know, it was never meant to be taken as literal as people have taken it.
And what about Simon's other point about the connection between rock climbing walls and
Well, that's a phenomenal, phenomenal, important point. The more flow you have, you are training the brain to pay attention in a specific way. You're training the brain to produce reactions. So, you know, as you pointed out, coding produces a lot of flow. There's a lot of flow in Silicon Valley anyways. And you could say that, you know, that flow is training them to be better rock climbers and put them into flow while rock climbing, or the flow that shows up while rock climbing is actually training them to get into flow in coding, right? It's essentially cross-training. So a lot of the action adventure sport athletes you'll see have very creative hobbies. They play. Danny Way, for example, plays in a band. And a lot of these guys, as they get older and want more flow in their lives, start taking on outside activities that also produce lots of flow.
Simon, thanks. Thanks for being a first-time caller and for listening to our program. Appreciate it. William writes in, what are the costs of flow? If it's so beneficial, why isn't it more accessible?
That's an interesting question, and I always tell people this is not self-help. Self-help is do these three things and your life gets better. Flow is different. Flow can be very, very dangerous. There's a dark side to flow, and I write about this in the book. The neurochemicals that underpin flow, there are five chemicals that showed up in flow. These are the five most addictive drugs the brain can produce, and flow appears to be one of the only times they're produced simultaneously. So these experiences are extremely addictive, and it is very easy to start having them and then get kicked out of the zone and not be able to get back there because you don't know what you're doing. So some of the answer is it's not more places, because it's only been in the past 10 years that we've had the neuroscience to peer under the hood and actually figure out what are these triggers, what's really creating the state, how do we get more of it. The other half is this is dangerous. It can go very wrong. You know, we've been talking about action adventure sport athletes. In 2011, we lost one professional athlete every 3 weeks. We just lost another base jumper a couple days ago. You know, these are the risk drives us up. This is not, you know, this is nothing to be taken lightly.
So let's pursue that for a moment, because one of the people you write about in the book is an extreme sport athlete skier by the name of Shane McConkie, who does these extraordinary things. And then you write about his death when something goes very wrong. And he crashes, dies, leaves behind a young wife and a three-year-old. You read that story, and it's hard to celebrate that, and yet I have a sense that you do, that you celebrate who he was and what he represented. But he also paid, obviously, the ultimate price. And I wonder if the three-year-old he left behind thinks it was all worthwhile.
Well, I'm not going to speak for, you know, Sherry McConkie or, you know, her family. I'm going to stay away from that. But what I will say is this. First of all, as I said earlier, flow does make you feel invincible up until the moment you're not. In Shane's case, that was a technical breakdown, right? The technology failed him, and that's what happened there. But the point that I think is worth mentioning is these people are literally pushing the bounds on what's actually possible for human beings, right? They're on the front edge, the far edge of kinesthetic possibility. When in the history of the world have we pushed into a brand new frontier without it costing lives? There's always a cost. To think that we could reinvent human performance and what's possible for human beings without people getting injured or killed along the way seems ignorant and silly to me.
I get that. But I guess the question to me is, it's one thing to risk your life in the advance of science or perhaps art, perhaps also athletics. But when something is as inherently dangerous as doing double flips skiing over mountains or whatever, I guess I'm wondering about whether or not it's possible to learn, to achieve, to push ourselves to new forms of creativity and to come alive, but not have that risk, not have that ultimate risk.
Well, this is a personal opinion, and I'm not advocating. First of all, let's be clear. If you look at the stats, skateboarding, skiing, snowboarding versus basketball, football, basketball, football, at an average level, that people are – those sports are – people are getting way more hurt, right, first of all, than they are in the action sports. Second of all, I honestly think that, especially in Western culture, we have pushed death out of the way. We don't see it. We hide it. We relegate our elderly to homes, and we don't – and I personally, I think that confronting mortality is extremely helpful to people, and it should, you know, we should seek it out a little more often. But that's how I choose to live my advice life, and I'm not giving that as advice to anybody.
To Anne next in San Francisco. Anne, go ahead, please.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a good segue from what you were talking, I think. Flow seems to me to be sort of inherently, it's amoral, and that you can do things with it that are highly narcissistic, or you could do things with it that are highly pro-social, or you could use it, you know, in a bank robbery or a, you know, jihadist adventure. What are your comments on that aspect of it?
Yeah, great question, Anne. Thank you.
It's a great question. And it's a tricky question because, you know, certainly like flow techniques, social flow, group flow, pickup artists use these same techniques, right? As you pointed out, this is it's a tool, and like all tools, it's morally neutral. But here's what's interesting, because I get asked about flow and super soldiers a lot, and for certain the U.S. Special Forces trains this way. Here's the thing to know. All five of the chemicals that show up in flow also enhance social bonding. So norepinephrine and dopamine is romantic love. Serotonin, which is another one, bonds people and reinforces love. Endorphins is maternal love. Between mothers and infants, and social bonding, Anne and mine does the same. So which is a long way of saying flow actually does make you more empathetic. So yes, the pickup artist can be using these techniques to be, you know, picking up girls, but simultaneously they're also becoming much more empathetic along the way. So it's an interesting question. Does one, you know, maybe you can subverted in the beginning, and maybe, you know, it comes back and turns us into better people farther on down the line. I also don't think we know yet.
And great question. Thank you for raising it and for being part of our program today. Lots and lots of questions coming in and comments as well. I'll read a few. Beth tweets, flow follows focus. Love this. And I've experienced this as a novelist. Ben writes, in high school, I had an after-school job, so when I was in class, I knew I had to pay extra attention because I wouldn't be able to read at night. I called it locking in, and I managed to get A's. The focus I got was amazing. Eric writes, I spent many years as a line cook and found that the perfect shift featured what we called line zen, which seems to be exactly the state you're describing. I would just inhabit myself and tasks, and it would be effortless and intuitive. It's probably the most addictive part of my career. It's interesting because you read about people who are in monasteries talking about, you know, the focus and intent they will bring to baking a loaf of bread. I mean, it's this really does cut across many, many different kinds of experiences. Oh. You wouldn't think of a line cook being in flow.
What most people don't realize, when Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi did his original study, he started out talking to experts. So there were ballet dancers and rock climbers and surgeons and whatnot. And then he went out and talked to Italian farmers and Navajo sheep herders and elderly Korean women and Detroit assembly line workers, and they all found flow.
Here's a veteran who writes, I experienced flow when deployed to Iraq in 2005. I was leading an organization of 100 pilots, engineers, and medics. Our mission was to provide air medical evacuation coverage for service members. We did this in every combat environment, high stakes, life and death. We were fortunate to all come back. Looking back, I feel as if the entire organization was at flow for 12 months. Now I'm a CEO in an early startup. There are 10 in my organization. I believe I'm in flow again with this team, and it's similar to my experience in Iraq.
No, that's great. Thanks for that.
Bruce writes, how does flow relate to sexuality?
Oh, that's interesting. I'm actually in town talking at the OMAX conference about this. And so one of the things that's interesting is A lot of what goes on in the brain during flow and what goes on in the brain during orgasm there are differences, but they're very similar. So in orgasm, big parts of the prefrontal cortex are turned off. It's why you vanish in orgasm. The neurochemicals are very similar. So there's a lot of overlap, and of course, sex is a great way to lose yourself in the moment. That's why, you know, it gives us a break from ourselves, which is I think one of the reasons we're so interested in it, shall we say.
And it also makes me think about the fact, both in sex, but also if you think about the experience of the veteran, there's another side to this, which is sort of letdown or loss of that. That people have written about how that there's a – they crave that and want to get back to that because there is such a heightened sense, whether it's in the sexual act or in conflict.
Well, I mean, to me, the best example of this, Maslow said years ago when he was writing about flow, he said that he believes that the state prevents suicide, that the experience is so powerful that even its periodic appearance is enough to make life worth living. And I think he's right, but I also think there's a flip side to it. And I think one of the reasons we see such high suicide rates among creatives is creatives get into flow, they do these great projects, and then they don't quite know what's going on. They come out of the project and they can't get back to the state. And you go from feeling like Superman to feeling much, you know, very average and mortal, and it's a tough, tough transition for a lot of people.
We're just about out of time, unfortunately. A number of people wanting to know how they get there. Rick writes, I'm a long-distance runner. I notice a flow sense occasionally when I'm running. What tips can your guests offer me to help me get to my training goals? I know you were saying before that this isn't a self-help book, and that's really not what flow is about. But you can see the amount of interest. And so in the brief 30 seconds or so that we have remaining, Stephen Kotler.
Absolutely.
Where would you like people to take this?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, you know, if you don't want to read Rise of Superman, don't worry about it. I put out a slide share that's free online that's the 17 flow triggers. So start there. Anybody can have it. And really, I think it's very individual. There are 17 flow triggers. Some are going to work better for others, and you have to experiment. You know, people always ask, what's your, you know, what's the big quote here? What's the takeaway? And I always think of Rilke, who said, live the questions. And I really think that's the point here.
And I will read once more, I guess, part of what I got from this, which is that quote from the civil rights leader Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, because what the world needs most is more people who have come alive. Thank you. Thanks for writing about this.
Thank you.
Stephen Kotler, the book again, The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi and Judy Campbell, with additional producing help today from Vinnie Tong. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Amanda Stupai is our engagement producer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.